discerninghearts.com, and Spirit Catholic Radio, in cooperation with the Pope Paul VI Institute, presents Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. Dr. Hilgers, after being deeply touched by the teachings of Pope Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae, founded the Pope Paul VI Institute for the Study of Human Reproduction in Omaha, Nebraska. Dr. Hilgers, along with his co-workers, developed the Creighton Model Fertility Care System. He would go on to discover Napro technology. In 1994, Pope John Paul II appointed him to full membership in the Pontifical Academy for Life. And with his wife Susan, Dr. Hilgers serves on the Pontifical Council for the Family. Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. We're talking about life, and one of the things that is one of the greatest dangers in this country, kills millions, is abortion.
Yeah, it's horrible. I actually trained in obstetrics and gynecology at the time when we didn't do abortions. Mm. We did fine. When everybody says you have to have abortion in order to practice medicine, I mean, there's people who actually believe that. You can't be an obstetrician gynecologist if you don't believe in abortion. It's not true at all. We've really gotten ourselves into a big hole with this whole thing. The Supreme Court really opened up a can of worms, a big time one, and this one is worse than that because it's killing everybody, all these babies and literally in the millions now.
It was, of course, a landmark decision, Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, Roe versus Wade handed down in January 1973, and I remember it very well. My wife and I actually got involved in the abortion issue in January of 1971. So we were involved a lot for the first 5 or 6 years of our own involvement. We started an organization called the National Youth Pro-Life Coalition, and we're really heavily involved in these sort of structural groups. But I was young, and I was a physician, and I was getting my training, and I felt like I had to do something that would dig in a little bit deeper on these issues than we were going. And that's one of the reasons that motivated me with Humanae Vitae as well. At a later time, well, actually, when I was at the Mayo Clinic, see, Judge Blackmun, who wrote the Roe versus Wade decision, had been an attorney for the Mayo Clinic before he became a judge and then before he was named Supreme Court Justice. And he knew a number of people in our department. And as I was a resident studying there, I got to know some of the attitudes on abortion of a number of the people who were obstetricians on the staff at the Mayo Clinic, and a number of them were really viciously pro-abortion, viciously so. So when the decision came down, actually we were in the middle of finishing up a book called Abortion and Social Justice, and it was just about ready to be published when this was handed down, so we felt like we had to pull it back and write some about the Supreme Court decision, so we did that. But in my research on that, I went in to look at all of the references in the Mayo Clinic Library, which is a medical library of quite sizable proportions, and I looked for all of the references that had been cited in Roe versus Wade. And of course, the legal ones weren't there, but all the medical ones that were cited were. And I started pulling out the books and looking at the card in the back as to who was signing them out. It turned out that a number of them, I mean, 30 or 40 of them, were all signed out by one individual. And it dawned on me that Justice Blackmun most likely had done some of his research at the Mayo Clinic Library. And so I went up sort of not after hours, but in the evening time, and I asked them, if you were a Supreme Court justice and wanted to do some research around here, where would you do that? And the librarian said, oh yeah, he was here, Justice Blackmun meaning. And he studied up there, and she pointed to a upstairs balcony area, private study area. And that the person's name who had appeared on the little card in the book was the head librarian. So that gave me an idea, and I said, I'm going to go and pull out every textbook on embryology that's in the Mayo Clinic Medical Library. Now, the Mayo Clinic is one sizable medical institution.
Very significant.
And this medical library is one of the best in the country. Mm-hmm. So I went out, and I must have pulled out 35 or 40 books on embryology. Not one was signed out by Justice Blackmun. Not one. So you know that he started this with a predisposed agenda. Mm-hmm. He had to. Otherwise, he would have been open-minded and looked at these textbooks, which clearly would say that life begins at conception. They would describe different things that happen during the course of the early phases of human development. was all laid out. Most of it was there, not necessarily always in human terms, because embryology is a study of structure and not as much as so much in terms of function. But nonetheless, it was still there if you wanted to look for it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he wanted to look for it, and so I was especially despairing after I saw that. But the decision, it was the most extreme that was ever written, and it allowed abortion in all three trimesters of pregnancy. It allowed for literally no control that you could put on the abortion procedure, especially in the first trimester of pregnancy. And it relied on some heavy-duty crusaders for abortion. Lawrence Lader, L-A-D-E-R, Lawrence Lader was a crusader for abortion in the late 60s and early 70s, and he wrote a book called Abortion, and it was, oh, let's see, it might be like, oh, I don't know, some newspaper columnist writing a book on infertility. And we'd give a lot of opinions and this sort of thing, but you wouldn't ever consider it being authoritative. That book, Lawrence Lader's book, Crusader for Abortion, was cited no less than 8 times in Roe v. Wade as an authoritative text. I don't think anybody's really looked at Roe v. Wade in terms of its academic integrity, but it's a horrible document. It is poorly written. I guess now that I said poorly written, I have heard that before. There are many people who do agree that it's been poorly argued and poorly written.
Just as case law.
Yeah, and I take that back a little bit, but I do think that we need to talk more about that because you know we're all of a sudden we take the Supreme Court as if this is God Himself coming down and making a decision about what's right and wrong, and in fact what goes into whatever their image is of what's right and wrong was horrible. It was just poorly written, poorly put together, relied on expert advice which frankly wasn't expert at all. It was crusading. It was people who desperately wanted abortion, and the real reality of abortion was ignored completely. So, anyway, for what it's worth, I think people need to know about these sorts of things. So if anything, they can see what the Supreme Court did in a little bit different light, and maybe just stir a little bit more interest in becoming involved in trying to reverse it all.
When you look at that decision, does not honor the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness for the child within inside the womb. And ultimately, we found that abortion has not been a mode for that as well in the life of women. Many women have suffered severe complications emotionally and physically.
Yeah, there's no question about it. And the people who have promoted abortion have often promoted it on the basis that it's really the key ingredient to women's liberation so that they can free themselves of this biological tyranny, they sometimes even say, which is reproduction or procreation. But, you know, as you study the complications that are related to abortion, I mean, you know, everything from infection that occurs in the uterus to hemorrhage, these things can occur, to perforation of the uterus and subsequent hysterectomy. I've seen patients who have had to have a hysterectomy after an early abortion, and they're 19 years of age and they have no future childbearing open to them as a result of that. And then you have long-term complications, which include adverse pregnancies in the subsequent conception of a pregnancy. Things like premature delivery are higher in women who've had previous abortions. Miscarriage rates are higher in women who've had a previous abortion. Stillbirths are higher. Abnormal placenta, if the placenta is located in the wrong place, are more common. And so placental abnormalities, I guess you could say, are more common in women who have had abortion. And then if you look at the emotional things, it's really interesting about the emotional aspects of all of this, because there's just no question that there's a significant percentage of women who have long-term scars, emotional scars, as a result of this. In my own practice, in working and dealing with women who have had abortions, the one thing that has struck me more than anything else, relative specifically to the emotional thing, is that they could be 10 years, 15 years, 20 years after that abortion, and just one comment like, what was the outcome of that pregnancy, and it was an abortion, can bring on an emotional reaction that in some ways you wouldn't really think would happen. If they had had their tonsils out 20 years ago, and you say, you know, how'd that surgery go, they wouldn't break down crying and become as emotional about it as they would under the circumstances of an abortion. It hangs on, it's permanent, it's long-term, and it's very, very difficult for them. And for the abortion people to say that it doesn't exist, it's just another part of the entire insensitivity that that exists in the argument for abortion. They really don't care if these women have emotional breakdowns. They're interested in only one thing, I guess, and that's making sure that abortion's always available. And any argument that might go contrary to that, they will belittle it, they will ridicule it, they will make it sound like whoever's making the argument is just lying, that they're not a good observer of the real issues and so forth. And when you talked about emotional, I mean, it's not just the women that are emotional about this. There have been studies on children who exist already in the family. For example, if you've got a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old or 4-year-old, whatever, and you have another one that's aborted, these children have emotional sequelae as well. Things like nightmares at night. They can't sleep very well. Somehow they think they could pull something like this, and the young children will never really realize what's going on. But they do. They sense these things. They're not as nearly so dumb as they like to make them out to be. And then the husbands and the boyfriends who are involved in this. There have been some studies done on the emotional reaction in them as well, because they're fathers of this baby, and they have absolutely nothing they can say about the life or death of this child. It's all in the hands of the woman. And it's their child too, but their child is being wiped out in front of them, and they have emotional scars. So it affects a lot of people, and these reactions are real. And we're not cultivating right now in our society or our culture a healthy psychology. We've created a psychology within the American culture, the Western culture, that is substantially unhealthy in trying to pawn it off as if it were healthy. And this goes back, if you go back to the divorce situation, you go back to the out-of-wedlock pregnancy situation, all these trends that we've observed, talked about here in this series of programs, to the unhealthy, emotionally unhealthy reaction to abortion, we've created an environment which is utterly unhealthy, a public health, if you will, that's unhealthy. And yet our institutions, our government agencies are set up almost to stoutly defend this. And it's really to the detriment of the entire culture. So we just have to become a lot more aggressive at trying to get this done, get it out of our culture.
We'll return to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers in just a moment.
England may be reconsidering the emotional toll of abortion.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
On February 1st, 2007, a day before her 31st birthday, a British artist named Emma Beck hanged herself. In her suicide note, she bemoaned aborting her unborn twins, saying, "I died when my babies died." Her story, which was recently reported after a year-long investigation, has shaken England. In response, England's Royal College of Psychiatrists announced that women should not be allowed to have an abortion until they're informed of the risks the procedure poses to their mental health. Pro-life Britons hope Parliament will enact the recommendation to help prevent such tragedies.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
A prayer to St. Gerard Majella for the respect of life. St. Gerard Majella, women the world over have adopted you as their patron in the joys and fears of childbearing. Today, we invoke your intercession for the unborn children in our world. Pray that all people will look upon human life as a gift from God, not as an unwanted burden to be destroyed. Assist the efforts of those enlisted in the crusade of promoting the dignity and value of all human life, particularly the unborn. This we ask through Christ our Lord. Amen.
Paul VI Institute Minute with Dr. Tom Hilgers.
The culture of life, that is a popular expression, but what is it? And what relevance does it have to any of us? In his encyclical letter, Evangelium Vitae, Pope John Paul the Great called the destruction of human life, those still to be born and those in their final stages, an extremely grave and disturbing situation. But equally alarming, he said, is the current darkening of conscience itself, which is making it, quote, difficult to distinguish
between good and evil and what concerns the basic value of human life, end of quote. Because of these trends, the pontiff called the 20th century an, quote, era of massive attacks on life, end of quote. Despite apparently convincing intentions, we are faced with, quote, an objective conspiracy against life, end of quote. This is a conspiracy which includes contraception, sterilization, abortion, and euthanasia. Building a culture of life at the Pope Paul VI Institute, I'm Dr. Tom Hilgers.
For a complimentary gift and more information on the Pope Paul VI Institute, log on to www.popepaul6.com. Spirit Catholic Radio presents Faith Check. Here's Greg Yule.
Many scoff at the Church's precepts and rules and can't fathom how our relationship with the Church could affect our relationship with Christ. Let us remember that the high priests of Israel, due to their office, could inquire of the Lord, and recall Caiaphas' prophecy about Jesus' mission, which John 11 states was not said of his own accord, but in virtue of his being high priest that year. Our Lord upheld the legitimacy of the teaching office when he said in Matthew 23, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat, so practice and observe whatever they tell you," though he quickly warned not to follow their bad example. Jesus commissioned his apostles to be the leaders of his church. He told them, "As the Father sent me, so I send you. And he who hears you, hears me. And he who rejects you, rejects me." The popes and bishops of the Catholic Church succeed the apostles in their teaching office. And it is they who over the centuries have passed on the faith to us through the creeds, church councils, even scripture itself. We are called to accept the church's teachings with joy, knowing that the church is a good mother who desires our eternal happiness. And after all, who could reject his own mother? This is Greg Yule for Faith Check.
We now return to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. You look at women who have been victims of abortion. Many cases, they were ignorant of what was occurring in their body and even to the child that they were carrying and that they were aborting. Once the knowledge is brought forward to them and there's a realization, it is horribly traumatic, as you pointed out in some of the instances that you've dealt with in your practice. Mm-hmm. What other medical procedure would a physician give to a patient and not explain all the potential complications? Say, this is what's going to occur. You may feel this afterwards. This may be something you have to watch out for. And yet, for all the women that I've encountered, no one ever spoke to them. No one ever explained. They were patted on the head and said, okay, we'll take care of your problem.
Right.
And then they're shown the door. I don't understand how the medical community can be outraged when there's an attempt to educate women about what happens in an abortion, educate families, parents, men, women, but yet they are some of the first to say, don't talk about it. Let's hide it. I mean, where else would we ever do that?
Well, one of the things we ought to do is look in the curriculum of the medical student and find out what these medical students or medical schools are actually teaching these young people. And some of it's horrible. I mean, there's sexuality things that are showing in pornographic movies so that they can desensitize them to sexuality-related issues, mm-hmm. so that they become avant-garde, they become liberal, they become open-minded, you know, all of these things that they want a doctor to be, theoretically, but nothing that is really realistic. Everything, I suppose, that's denying reality. And then you get into the clinics and you see how other doctors, the ones who are teaching you, integrate this to their own practice and make it sound like if you don't do this, you're going to be really crippled in your ability to practice medicine. So, I mean, it's all part and parcel of what they are as they grow up through this medical progress that we have, this medical education system that we've developed over the years. They've had a free rein as to what they can give to medical students. And most medical students, to be honest, are just so happy to be medical students because it's very competitive to get into medical school. And, you know, the last thing they're going to do is cause a fuss about it because, you know, they're literally afraid they might get kicked out of medical school for it. And that's probably not an irrational fear. So they're not doing anything about it, perhaps for some reasons that might actually be legitimate. And then the faculty people, well, they're all the avant-garde, right-thinking kind of folks anyway, by their own admission.
Mm-hmm.
And so these, you ask, how can a medical profession do this? Honest to God, it's hard to figure. It's hard to understand, and I'm not here to tell you that I understand it. But I will tell you, there are things that they go through that cultivate this. I mean, absolutely on purpose cultivate those attitudes amongst doctors that can look the other way and somehow see it as avant-garde. You know, kind of reminds me a little bit of when I was in medical school and you had the patient with cancer, maybe a terminal cancer, and it was diagnosed. And a few years before I got to medical school, they wouldn't tell the person that they had cancer because the medical profession felt, well, they can't handle it, so I'll just take it. I can handle it because I'm a doctor, but they can't handle it, so I'm going to keep it from them. Well, then a lot of bad things happened as a result of that because people were ticked off. The doctor didn't explain better what was happening to grandma or grandpa or whatever. And so they came around to the idea, well, okay, now we can tell them. So when I was going through medical school, the big thing was let's tell them because they can get their life together. They can do a lot of things and get some support and so forth. And of course, that's continued ever since, and it's been generally pretty good. But now we're back to the same old thing all over again, except it's the beginning of life. Well, we won't tell them. They can't handle it. You know, we won't explain to society what we're really doing because the society, I mean, after all, we're at the cutting edge of all of this. That's where we're doctors. We're right there at the edge of all of the new technological advancements. And, you know, after all, you have to have a medical degree to understand any of this stuff. So we just won't tell them. Well, and that's kind of where we've been at, and we've got to get out of that. We've got to start being honest with people about what this is all about, and don't camouflage it and don't cover it up.
You don't even have to apply a theological dimension to this discussion, because I think, isn't it standard in every medical school, at least philosophy 101, ethics? I mean, isn't there an ethical component about the definition of the human person?
No. No, you'd be surprised. I mean, they may have some ethics component, but it's all watered down situation ethics.
Oh, wow.
I mean, the situation ethics people, the people who have led this ethical change are the ones running the ethics courses in the medical schools.
Wow.
And so we don't, they do have a little bit of an ethics dimension, but it's very simplistic, and it's not consistent, and for sure not consistent with Catholic ethics. And in fact, they would belittle Catholic ethics because Catholics are all hung up on this or hung up on that. You know, they've got all sorts of reasons for doing that, none all of which are very superficial and none of which are based in evidence. I like to get back to that because evidence-based medicine means everything to the doctor until they get to evidence they don't want to really disclose or tell people. So, I mean, there's evidence out there that we're destroying a human life. There's medical evidence that says that. But where's the evidence? You don't hear it talked about. You don't hear it written about. You just hear about it's a simple procedure. You just do a DNC, and the woman somehow is automatically cured of all of her social problems. Well, we've been through the litany of social and medical consequences of all of this, and it's absolutely 100% certain that this has not solved any social problem. It's only created more social problems. So we have to come to grips with that as well, because if we're talking about evidence, the evidence is clearly in favor of the position that the institution now of contraception and abortion on a widespread basis, as we have seen it, has created nothing but difficulties and problems and has not improved anything and has just created a litany of these victims, a litany of these after effects. And yet, but they keep saying, well, it's going to solve these social problems, but it hasn't. It absolutely 100% has not. So we've got to get wind of that too, and we've got to, you know, challenge them better on all of this.
It's such a shame that for those individuals who so much of society, particularly women, trust with their lives, they put their lives in the hands of physicians that are, you think they're looking out for you.
Yeah.
And to know that may not necessarily be the best place of that trust. It's heartbreaking.
I tell people that a lot of times physicians practice medicine for other physicians. They don't practice medicine for the patient. And it's surprising to people because they just can't imagine that. Now, there is definitely a group of doctors who do practice medicine for the patient, so I don't want to make this more than it really is, but there's no question that there's a group, significantly large group of physicians who mostly practice so that they look good to their colleagues. And whatever they do with regard to the patient is something that they could care less about because the patient, they don't care if they think good of them or bad of them, I guess. It's make sure their colleagues think good or bad of them. And people can easily get into that rut. And I think I've been fortunate in personally in being able to somehow stay away from that. And I'm sure it's because of my own religious background, my own philosophical moorings, if you will, completely bred in a Catholic environment, that my emphasis has always been on the patient. And I frankly don't care what my colleagues think, to be honest. It's nice if they think I'm doing a good thing or not such a good thing, but ultimately I want to do the best I can for that patient. And what we're doing in medicine today is not necessarily for the good of that patient. And that's hard because you're dealing with a profession that is sufficiently specialized. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of research articles published every year on all of these different topics. There's no way that an individual physician can keep up with all of that. So how could the lay public possibly keep up with it? And there's a certain element of that. But it's incredible how the profession has developed along these lines.
Dr. Hilders, all I can think of is, for what you do to the least of these, you do unto me. And I'm buoyed by the fact that the Pope Paul VI Institute is not only through your leadership is training men and women who have the dignity of each human person, the female, the male, and the small child, no matter how small, that dignity, upholding that, it gives us hope. It gives us hope and a place to turn.
Well, I appreciate that. But in reality, we're only at the very beginning of all of this. And there's so much work to be done and so much reaching out to other physicians and even medical students and others and the clergy. I mean, it's a social disease, if you will, almost. And it's a lot of work to be done. But we've got to start on it now, and I'm really grateful. But for some of these doctors, it's really difficult for them. They go back home and they get criticized, they get ridiculed. You can kind of see in a way why they end up practicing for other doctors. Because in some cases, those doctors will prevent them from doing things because they don't understand it, so it can't be. I have never heard of this before, so it just can't be anything that's good for anybody.
We'll pray for courage on their part.
Yeah.
And perseverance for everyone on staff at Pope Paul VI Institute. We thank you so much, Dr. Hilders, for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be here.
You've been listening to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilders. To hear and or to download this episode, along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. To learn more about the work of Dr. Hilders and the Pope Paul VI Institute, go to popepaulvi.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com, Spirit Catholic Radio, and the Pope Paul VI Institute. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join us next time for Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilders.